a new Seattle basketball team, an arena to go with it. Would that unite us in fun? Would that jeopardize our working waterfront? Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In coming decades, do you want Seattle to have more blue-collar jobs? Do you want more entertainment, like more pro sports? Do you think we could have both? These questions are at the heart of a debate over the future of the SoTo neighborhood. The city council is expected to decide this month whether to give up a part of a street, Occidental Avenue, so developers can build a new basketball arena in SoTo. Now you're going to hear two points of view on this. Brian Robinson with the blog SonicsRising.com, an unofficial basketball fan site. And opposing this new SoTo arena, Seattle land use attorney Cleveland Stockmeyer. We're going to start with him. Stockmeyer says putting an arena in SoTo is an attack on Seattle's industrial character, its working port, and the blue-collar jobs that go with it.
It could turn SoTo, the huge light industrial area, into kind of a entertainment, condo, yuppie playland, causing the loss of thousands of manufacturing and distribution jobs in our economic diversity in Seattle that we value.
Okay, before we talk yuppie playland, Brian Robinson, you support this SoTo arena. You just heard that it would kill the port of Seattle. What do you say?
You know, I just have to take issue at what I think is a lack of discretion or lack of honest facts on this. I take issue with the concept that the vacation of an alley and the loss of one block for an arena will somehow destroy the entire port and all of its jobs.
Cleveland, why do you think this is port destroying?
We have a unique asset in Seattle, and it's central to our soul. It's a deep water port. The containers shift to rail trains 1.5 football fields away from the proposed arena. This is the major intermodal freight transfer point for the entire northwest quadrant of North America, and all those containers going east, all those containers full of apples going west. If we degrade that and harm that with other uses, we lose the one-day advantage we have over Long Beach going to Asia.
You know, the port and their supporters such as Cleve have had 5 years now to produce a traffic study that substantiates those claims. And they have not been able to do so. Heffron Transportation is a consultant that's basically on retainer with the port. They've produced no new information whatsoever. The other asset we have down in SoTo is the convergence of, I believe, 5 different transit options with light rail, ferry, for, 2 different highways, and train service coming. So there are many reasons to look at that area for entertainment. That is why we have a stadium district located in SoTo.
You disagree on what the effect would be on Port of Seattle movement of goods. Let's talk about Cleveland's argument that, Brian, you and the stadium supporters want to turn a working area, SoTo, into a yuppie playland. What do you envision the neighborhood being, and why?
You know, I think one of the great things our city has done is really spent a lot of time planning for that corridor and trying to map out a future for industry there. And there is a stadium district with a very clear, definitive boundary. There is a heavy haul corridor, and there is a protected industrial community that is south of Lander Street. Everything they've done there to protect the stadium ensures that encroachment will not occur south of that line, but nothing they are proposing would ever prevent the development of offices and yuppification, as we refer to it, of the area that's currently contemplated as a stadium.
Cleveland, what's the problem with it being a place to play and drink a beer and watch a game, et cetera?
Well, you know, I love yuppies. You could say I am one myself. But we already have provided for the high-tech industry, and we saw South Lake Union, a light industrial area, turn over to be the high-tech mecca that it is, if you don't like playland. You know, talking about encroachment, this is like saying there's a firm line between the Soviet Union and Poland that keeps them from encroaching, and then they encroach. The city cannot be turned over, not all of it, to high-tech jobs and high-priced condos. If you do not preserve light industrial, if you do not preserve the infrastructure we have, this freight rail, marine rail nexus, it will be gone. You've got the Port of Seattle crying out to be heard. I think when our port tells us it harms the port, we should believe that. It's really all about, you know, can high tech and the gentrification have all of Seattle or not? Will we keep our soul or not, our diversity?
Brian, if you're not persuaded by an economic diversity argument, let's talk about soul. Cleveland said that the port marine trade is part of the history and the soul of Seattle. You can go anywhere and watch pro sports. What do you say about soul?
I say the soul of a community is constantly evolving. And anyone who says that they understand and define it and own it really is a NIMBY at heart. My family was raised in Industrial Ballard. My father was the president of the North Seattle Industrial Association. I've watched everything happen there. I value industrial jobs. I value the idea of having strong mix in Inner Bay and in the Duwamish district. I think we need to look at it, but that doesn't mean they own and represent the entire soul of the community. Thousands and thousands of people have talked about having a first-class venue for music, for sports. It brings a community together in a way that's just indefinable. So I'm proud of my soul, too.
Well, it is indefinable, but let's just cut to the chase here. Sports are wonderful. Pro sports are wonderful. Why can't they pay their own way? Why can't they put it somewhere where it's not one football field away from our intermodal SIG yards and the unique deep water port?
You want it in Tukwila instead,
well,
right? Or somewhere
the arena,
else.
There are a lot of places it can go. We can't move the port. If you want to let the market rule, it means no zoning and it means SOTO becomes the new South Lake Union. I'm not against South Lake Union. We have it. We wanted it. We've developed it. But it shouldn't have all of Seattle.
Brian, why not Tukwila or someplace else, not right where the port doesn't want it to be?
Those locations are not viable and they are red herrings. There are no investors willing to participate in key arena renovation. And in fact, there are really significant traffic and neighborhood issues there as well. And there are no credible investors left pursuing a Tukwila option. It makes sense to put a stadium in the stadium district, which is adjacent to a clearly defined industrial district, but to take advantage of the transit in that region and to respect the boundaries that were already drawn between the industrial community and the stadium district.
Okay, finally, I'd like each of you to lay out what you want SOTO to look like in 10 years and why that's the right direction for Seattle.
I want SOTO to remain SOTO and to not become South Lake Union. I want SOTO to keep the blue-collar jobs, the marine, rail, freight transfer. That's part of the soul of Seattle.
Brian, what's your vision for SOTO in 10 years and why?
I want the stadium district to host all of our stadiums, for the port to consider cruise terminal capacity, and to have a great walking district connecting the arena and stadium district to Key Arena with a multi-billion-dollar waterfront project that is going to be the vision of the world, then everything south of Lander is industry as it should be.
Brian Robinson manages the website SonicsRising.com, an unofficial basketball fan site. Cleveland Stockmeyer is a land use attorney in Seattle. Who persuaded you? You just heard the visions. You heard Yuppie Playland. You heard about Seattle's soul. You heard about a working port. What does Seattle mean to you? What's at stake in this SOTO arena debate? Let us know on Twitter, at KUOW. We're live tweeting the show right now. And you do have a say in this right now, because the Seattle City Council is expected to vote this month whether or not to give up part of Occidental Avenue for the development of this proposed sports arena in the SOTO neighborhood of Seattle. You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Good afternoon. For new police officers, making that leap from the academy to the real world can be a big transition. It's no longer an exercise. Now the dangers and the rewards are real. KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel got a glimpse of life as a rookie cop in Bellevue.
Officer Stephanie Schendel has been working patrol in the city of Bellevue for about 5 months. On this night, one of her first stops is the scene of a burglary. The resident tells her his rifle and pistol have been stolen.
If you could do your best to track down the serial numbers, because if we have them, it'll make it easier if they try and resell them,
sure,
or if they pop up later in a crime.
Okay.
Schendel says she sees a lot of burglaries where the focus is guns, jewelry, and the medicine cabinet. Next up, a call about some shoplifters at the Whole Foods grocery store.
So it's a theft in progress. The person's getting away.
but it's a, it is a misdemeanor. So am I going to drive lights and sirens there? No. I'm more likely to get in an accident when I'm driving code with some normal person. So it's, everything's about risk assessment.
That night, the shoplifters get away, but Schendel documents what happened with store employees. We first met Stephanie Schendel last year as she made her way through the Washington State Police Academy. Schendel started out as a print journalist, but got so interested in covering police work that she decided to do something more proactive, as she describes it, and become an officer herself.
That's why, you know, I love journalism, because you got like crazy stories out of it, and then now I have like the front row seat.
At the academy, Schendel's instructors emphasized the role of police as guardians of society, who show respect for others, communicate clearly, and de-escalate conflicts when possible. Schendel says her training with the Bellevue Police Department had a different focus.
Part of when you enter field training is rounding it out to, yes, it's, there are times in your job where you're going to be a guardian. But once you get on the road, you need to recognize when you need to turn that off and when you need to be the person with the confidence level to take someone's freedom away.
Schendel says high-profile cases of police misconduct make every officer's job harder, and she tries to counter people's fears of police. But she's also haunted by the story of a police officer in Virginia who was shot and killed on her first day of field training in February.
There are points in our job that are extremely dangerous, and we're dealing with people who are very unpredictable. One of the things that was really focused with my training with Bellevue and with other recruits coming out of the academy was recognizing those threats and how to appropriately dealing with those.
Schendel says she wanted to work for Bellevue because the department is progressive and already has lots of women officers. She says they built on her training at the academy rather than telling her to disregard it. Besides the risks of the job, she says the hardest part so far has been dealing with very troubled kids.
Handcuffing a 12-year-old to take him into protective custody is not fun. But if I didn't handcuff him, and because the kid didn't want to go to the hospital, but if I didn't do that and the kid decides, I'm going to make a run for it, and the kid gets away from me, and then the kid gets hurt, whose fault is that? It's mine.
She says these kids' situations can feel hopeless. It's helped her to talk with colleagues and her family about what she sees. On this night, things are pretty calm. She jokes that in her police car, she only sees perfect drivers.
The second you're in a patrol car, it's like a bubble. No one does anything wrong.
Suddenly, an oncoming car does an illegal U-turn right in front of her.
Yeah, we're going to pull over. 3.8 radio, can you divert me for traffic?
The driver turns out to be a very recent arrival in the U.S. Schendel gives him a warning. She says her favorite part of the job is its unpredictability and being a guardian when called for.
When you roll up on a car accident, everyone is freaking out, and you get to be the person that says, hey, you know, like, I know everything seems really bad right now, but in the end, you're okay. You didn't get hurt. So being the one who's able to, like, kind of put that in perspective for people is good. And, you know, there are calls where you actually get to help people who need it.
Schendel says one of the more surprising repercussions to her career change has been in her dating life. The men she met seemed intimidated by her job.
Like, they tried to outman me almost, you know, like, it was just so silly to me because I'm like, oh, wow, congratulations. I'm so impressed.
Another unsuccessful icebreaker, making off-putting jokes about her handcuffs. But she recognizes that becoming a police officer changed her values, too.
What also changed was the type of guy that I found myself attracted to. It's like I realized that I was like, I don't really have much in common anymore with, you know, someone who's like an accountant.
She is dating someone now. Schendel says the next obstacle is actually spending time together, given the crazy shifts many young officers are assigned to work. In Bellevue, I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
A little glimpse of life as a rookie cop with Amy Radel. And tomorrow we're going to look at the impact of the president's task force on 21st century policing 1 year later. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. What's it like outside? Because I'm stuck in a windowless radio studio and it was supposed to be 80 degrees today and my thermometer says 66. What is it like outside? Are you eating in the sun? Are we underdressed? Are you pretending to be sick? If I can't be outside, please be outside for me and report back to the rest of us on Twitter at KUOW. Over the past year, the University of Washington has been holding a quarterly forum about race and equity on campus. This week, the forum was interrupted by hundreds of student protesters, including senior Palka Shabali.
We want to see a university that doesn't just talk about diversity, that doesn't just talk about race and equity, but is truly committed to acting upon race and equitable actions.
Shabali says the University of Washington has been having the wrong conversation.
We should be having discussions that sound like, when will the university divest from the prison industrial complex? When will we hire more faculty of color? When will we address UWPD police brutality on black bodies? Those are the types of conversations that we should have that will tell us that, yes, this university is truly committed to anti-racism.
At this week's event, the event that Shabali and other protesters interrupted, was Vice Provost Ed Taylor. He's the UW's Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs. He says the protesters make some good points about race and equity, but Shabali and other students have a list of actions that they want the UW to move on now, like increasing faculty of color by 25% in the next year. I asked Vice Provost Ed Taylor, will that happen?
The university absolutely wants to increase faculty of color. That's real work, and that's work that we're going to be about. Can we do it by the numbers that our students are asking? I don't know, but that's work that we're going to be doing, and that's work that our schools and colleges are going to be doing. That's work that the president of our university is committed to, and that's meaningful work. There's also something underneath that request. It's not just the numbers that students, they're going to put the number out there, but they're also talking about the experience of teaching and learning. They're talking about who teaches them and how they get taught and who they encounter and who they mentor them. And that's serious work also. So we're going to take all those things into consideration and change the face of the campus in many respects to meet up to the expectations of our students and to meet our own expectations. So they're pushing hard on those issues, and we understand why, and we understand how. It's real work, and it takes time.
I'll tick off a few more. Shabali told me that they want pipeline programs created from grade school to college focusing on mostly black and brown schools. Ceasing of racial and sexual harassment of UW workers of color. She wants the university to divest from using prison labor, stop police brutality by UW police, and to address an ingrained history of sexual assault, particularly in the frats and the Greek system. And she says, finally, that the university's been more talk than action. Mm-hmm. What actions do the university plan to take?
Some of those issues are spot on. Yes, we need pipeline programs. And in this case, our student, and this student in particular, she's right. This isn't something that's going to happen because we're recruiting harder in high school. When she's talking pipelines programs, and our students are talking pipeline programs, they're saying, let's reach deep, let's reach into communities, and let's follow students through. And they know the data, particularly with respect to African-American students. I follow this also and know that we need to make deep, deep commitments. In order for this to work in higher education, we need to start early. We need to start preschool. We need to be engaging communities and engaging in communities. And that's a deep commitment on behalf of the university, and that's something that we have to do and need to do in partnership with the city, with the county, and with public schools. That doesn't mean it should take forever. That means that we all need to work with a sense of urgency. And what's amazing about our students is they're not single-issue students. They're talking about race. They're talking about class. They're talking about gender. They're talking about the ways in which these issues intersect. And they're holding us accountable to being the kind of university that truly is living up to its public mission. So there again, those are challenging issues. We're having to hear them. We're having to hear them from the heart and minds and experiences of students. So when students tell us that they experience a certain harshness in the classroom or that they experience a certain harshness in the community, we need to be responsive to that and hear them and walk with them, create policies, examine institutional policies that serve students and our faculty and staff as well. Look at forms of inequity that exist and handle them in real time.
That UW senior, Palka Shabali, gave me a very clear message that the kind of words that you are giving are soothing words that are essentially saying, this will take time. And she's saying, we don't have time. And in fact, these are not new demands. People have been calling for racial and gender equity since at least the 60s. So she wants to know, you're going to do what and when?
We're increasing the number of students. We are reaching harder to actually increase the number of students of color, and they're asking with specific groups, African-American students, Latino students. You're looking at a trend line where our Hispanic student numbers have gone up. Again, it's not just about the numbers. It's about the quality of the experience for students. We're increasing the number of faculty. That takes a process because this isn't just about saying we're going to increase the number of faculty by 15 or 20 or 30. There are hard numbers there, but the process of recruiting faculty, the process of creating an environment where our faculty will stay and do their very best work, that requires kind of institutional change and commitment. So it's not just words. We're looking at the data. We're meeting students eye to eye on this. We're holding ourselves accountable. So it's important to actually set metrics out there and for us to meet those metrics as well. That's work that our schools and colleges are doing. I left the conversation with deans this morning. This is important work for us, and it's important not for us just to talk about it, but it's important for us to do it. You'll see action on all these fronts.
We've been talking about student demands. I wonder, what's one concrete change that you would like to see at the University of Washington, and why?
Bill, a big thing that I missed out in terms of a big change at the university. We're in the first year of having Anamari Kausay as our president. And here's something just very unique and something very powerful. First female president at the University of Washington, first Latina president at the University of Washington, and at least in my term, in my time here, the most devoted president that I've had the opportunity to work with. And it's inspiring to actually have somebody who has rolled her sleeves up and said, we're going to have this race and equity initiative, and we're going to push ourselves, and we're going to do right. And there were particular reasons why she started this. That's a remarkable change, and this is an incredible moment. The reason why the students are pushing so hard is because they're driven, and they're driven for the right reasons. But it's also important to note that the students are pushing because we had a president make a declaration that this matters, that race and equity matters. So that's an important change for us, and that's an important moment for us.
Ed Taylor, Vice Provost and the Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs at the University of Washington. You can hear my initial interviews with UW senior Palka Shabale and more of our coverage of race and equity on campus at KUOW.org. I'm Bill Radke. Congratulations on living a life that allows you to be outside right now. MLB tweets it's awesome, and so is his ice cream. And Heather reports there's zero parking at Gasworks Park, so you might just want to swim there. Still, it's only in the 60s, not in the 80s. 12:32 the time, I'm Bill Radke. Nearly 83,000 U.S. service members are still listed as missing in action from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and other conflicts. Well, new DNA processes are offering more hope than before to families waiting for their loved ones' remains. KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports on military and veterans.
The mood at the Marriott in Bellevue, Washington is lively, considering the reason that people have gathered here. It's going to be a long day. From 7:30 in the morning until 5 this evening, the families packed into this ballroom will be briefed on what the government is doing to recover the remains of their loved ones. But first, one by one, they stand up to remember those they've lost.
My name is Marcia Welch, and I would like to remember my husband, Robert John Welch. He went down in January 16, 1967. I was 30 and he was almost 41.
It's a chance for many to tell the story of their loved one to fresh ears, to offer support and friendship to those who share a similar loss.
I live in Port Angeles, Washington, so if any of you ever come through there, want to say hi, I'd send M. Welch in the phone book, and I'd love to have you see his little mini farm that I bought for him 50 years ago. 5 acre, but it's precious home, sweet home. So hopefully someday he'll be there.
Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency Director Michael Linnington has only been on the job 10 months, but tells the families he considers this the most important duty he's ever had.
Accounting for those that chose to serve our nation, went to war, and never came home is the ultimate responsibility, I believe.
For widows like Welch, who's 80, there's more hope than in the past. A simple cheek swab from a family member now can provide enough DNA to identify remains. In 2015, the agency identified 72 service members' remains, but it has hundreds more in boxes whose identities aren't known. And Linnington says some remains are still out there.
Especially in Southeast Asia, time has not been on our side. The acidic nature of the soil, the difficulty of grabbing witnesses to the incidents, and putting those difficult cases together from the Vietnam War has always been a challenge.
Even all these years later, government secrecy can still get in the way of helping families determine what happened to their loved ones.
My name is Carolyn Gill, and my father is Tech Sergeant Moen A. Holland.
Holland was sent to Laos in 1968. His family is still trying to learn what his mission was and what happened to him.
And I'm begging you not to close my father's case. Technology, DNA, everything changes all the time. And I just say, don't ever give up. We've not given up, and we expect our government to do the same.
Linnington, the agency director, was an Army officer for more than three decades. The warrior ethos about never leaving a fallen comrade drives him and many of his staff. But ultimately, Linnington knows some families will never get the answers they seek.
Our mission is to provide the fullest possible accounting for our missing personnel to the families and our nation. We also know we'll never really achieve full accounting for all of our missing personnel, because many of them that are missing are in places that we know they are unrecoverable, deep in the ocean.
Few of the families in this Marriott ballroom seem to be ready to give up hope that some connection to their loved one's story will be found, which is a big part of the reason the agency holds events like this one. It's an opportunity for families to ask questions, to talk about their loved ones, and for the government to reaffirm its commitment to the missing. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
Our stories on the military and veterans are part of the American Homefront Project, a national collaboration with NPR, KUOW, WUNC in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, and KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Bill Radke. Now that recreational marijuana is legal in Oregon, some pot activists and entrepreneurs are taking the next step. They're running for office themselves. KUOW's Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
5 years ago, Bree Malarkey and her family decided they were tired of the hectic pace of life in the Willamette Valley. They bought 40 acres outside the southern Oregon town of Shady Cove. They have a few goats and an enormous herb garden.
This is motherwort. It's getting ready for its very first harvest. Echinacea over here is just starting to pop.
And that's not all.
We have lemon balm, chamomile, catnip, and cannabis all growing side by side.
That's right. One of her crops is cannabis, as in marijuana. And not only does she grow the stuff, she sells it. Malarkey runs two Southern Oregon dispensaries that sell to both recreational and medical customers. As a marijuana business owner, she closely followed the legislature's actions on marijuana over the past 2 years. And she says she came to this conclusion.
The overburdensome regulations that many legislators were putting into place and administrative rules as the agencies implemented the programs were not going to be advantageous to starting a successful small business enterprise here in Oregon.
And so she decided to throw her hat in the ring. She's running for a seat in the Oregon House. It's her first run for public office. She's one of three legislative candidates in Oregon this year with close ties to marijuana, either as business people or as activists. Others are running for local offices.
These are really symbolic gestures.
Amy Margolis isn't sure any of the candidates will win. Margolis heads a marijuana industry group called the Oregon Cannabis Association. She says she looks forward to a time when office holders have a level of expertise in the subject and don't have to be schooled in Pot 101. But she says even if they don't win, just running is a logical next step.
I think you're going to see different levels of seriousness and different levels of sophistication with that engagement. But that's what it demonstrates to me, is that the activists are maturing in their approach.
And Margolis says not all of the candidates even want the same thing. While Bree Malarkey is concerned about regulations on her business, Tyler Gabriel says he's running for the Oregon House because he's worried about possible threats to the state's medical marijuana program.
The state of Oregon seems to think that they can eliminate the medical marijuana program and eliminate medicine from their patients and have it all taxed like as if they're recreational users. That's their goal, and that's what's slowly happening. and I want to prevent that.
Gabriel is running in a house district in north central Oregon. He's a medical marijuana patient who also grows for other patients. A third legislative candidate is Stormy Ray, a longtime medical marijuana activist who's running for a state Senate seat in eastern Oregon. Regardless of whether they win or not, the political climate around marijuana is a far cry from 1992. That's when Bill Clinton famously said on TV,
I experimented with marijuana a time or two and I didn't like it. And didn't inhale and never tried it again.
I didn't inhale became a national punchline, but Clinton, of course, went on to become president. Bree Malarkey says as a young adult, she actually got to meet Clinton during that campaign. And ironically, despite growing and selling marijuana, she's used it even less than the former president.
I personally don't use cannabis. I don't have a medical need, but I believe in freedom of choice, and I believe in people being able to have safe access to make their own decisions for their own body. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Come November, Malarkey's party affiliation could be a bigger political liability than her cannabis career. She's seeking to oust the top Republican in the Oregon House in a district where GOP voters far outnumber Democrats. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
This is KUOW's The Record. Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray and Washington Governor Jay Inslee have banned official city and state travel to North Carolina, part of a national protest over passage of a new law in that state. Reporter Laura Leslie is Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL in Raleigh, North Carolina. She reminds us that new law bans North Carolina's city and county governments from passing any anti-discrimination protections for gay, lesbian, and transgender people.
There were municipalities around the state that had passed some protections for LGBTQ people. All of those are thrown out, and no other city can make any laws to protect gay and lesbian people. Now, in North Carolina, prior to this, to be fair, it is currently legal to be fired for being gay or to be refused housing or refused service. What this does is basically ensure that no city can add additional protections. And so, of course, it's being called the most anti-gay law that was in consideration at the time. You know, and obviously people here are very upset about it. We had protests in the streets. We had transgender protests in front of the governor's mansion. We had students closing down the main street in Chapel Hill for hours shortly after this was passed. But there have been protests on the other side as well. A lot of social conservatives and religious groups think that this is protecting their religious freedom, so they're very much in support of this bill.
People far from North Carolina who just know it's a southern state might assume it's completely socially conservative. How conservative is North Carolina, would you say?
That depends completely on where you are, because, you know, here in which we call the Research Triangle, we have a ton of tech. We have a lot of universities. It's actually a very progressive place. But rural North Carolina remains extremely socially conservative. So, you know, there's a lot of tension between rural and urban areas in North Carolina. Social issues is just one of those many. And legislators have been basically taking a lot of authority away from cities over the last few years as sort of part of that struggle. And this is just sort of one more additional point of conflict.
As you know, City of Seattle and Washington State have protested this North Carolina law by banning official city and state employee travel to North Carolina. And how are North Carolinians reacting to that?
You know, a lot of people in the state know pretty strongly how they feel on this, one side or the other. The folks who already don't agree with the new law see that as support, obviously, which is important. And it's bad for the state's image. I mean, it is to them. But then on the other side, you've got the folks who supported this, and they say, well, it's a travel ban. You know, what kind of impact is that really going to have on us economically? You know, so they're pretty well dug into their position.
Are there North Carolina conservatives saying, see, now you know what they think up in hippie liberal Seattle, Washington. Let's not be like them.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some of that sort of, you know, circling the wagons and saying, well, you know, that's their values. And, you know, obviously they don't share our values. And, you know, they feel very strongly, some of them, that this has to do with danger from possible sexual predators, which obviously isn't borne out by the facts that have happened in different cities. There's more than 100 of them around the country that have these ordinances, these restroom ordinances, and we have not seen an epidemic of attacks in restrooms.
Some of us way up here in the upper left-hand corner don't know much about North Carolina. You've gotten our attention this week. Is there something you want to tell us about your state that maybe doesn't fit our picture?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people here would say that this bill does not represent North Carolina. You know, there are a lot of businesses here who are very inclusive. We have a lot of high tech. We have a lot of very progressive communities. You know, a lot of folks here feel very strongly that this is a misrepresentation of North Carolina, not just today, but of sort of what they consider to be North Carolina values of fairness and equal treatment. But, you know, there are some other folks here who would say this is very much what North Carolina is about. We feel strongly about social values and conservative values, and we're putting our money where our mouth is.
So finally, Laura, the country's watching to see whether this controversial law is going to fall. What do you expect will happen?
I have not heard anyone talking about repealing it in leadership here. You know, I think they feel like they have sort of planted their flag here. You have to remember we have a governor who is undergoing one of the probably toughest reelection fights in the nation coming up this fall. He has definitely staked his claim on this legislation and is backing it. It may get him a couple of points in the polls come November. As you can imagine, it's also becoming fodder for the other side, for our Attorney General Roy Cooper, the Democratic candidate who's challenging him. So I just don't see, you know, it's become such a politically entrenched issue at this point that I just don't see a lot of movement among Republican legislative leaders to step back on this.
Laura Leslie, Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL in Raleigh, North Carolina. Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray, Washington Governor Jay Inslee have banned official city and state travel to North Carolina in reaction to the passage of that new anti-LGBTQ law in that state. Murray and Inslee have issued a similar travel ban in response to a law passed in Mississippi. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We're used to bad news when it comes to the oceans of the world. Here's a little optimism. We can turn around the global decline in fish stocks in about 10 years. This means more fish in the ocean, more catch from those fish, and more profits from the catch, if we're willing to make changes in how we manage fisheries. University of Washington fisheries professor Ray Hilborn was one of the researchers involved with figuring all this out. So I asked him, how do we get there?
Well, for the first step is to start managing fisheries in the places in the world where they're largely unregulated. Now, that doesn't include the U.S. It doesn't include Europe. This is mostly in Asia and Africa. The second step is to go all the way to what we call catch shares, which is where instead of having a competitive fishery, all the participants in the fishery have an allocated share of the catch, and they can no longer make more money by trying to catch more fish. They make more money by being efficient in how they fish and in trying to get a higher value for their product.
How does this allocation, this catch share, how does that affect your average worker on a fishing boat?
Ah, well, it depends on how it's done. And historically, the way we've done it, it hasn't been good for the average worker on some fishing boats, at least in the sense that when you go into catch shares, you almost always see a major reduction in how much fishing there is, the number of boats. Fewer boats catch a greater share of the fish. It becomes more economically efficient, but it means there's fewer crewmen. And the crewmen that still have jobs often do very well, but you see a reduction in employment. So that's a downside. And there's a lot of debate about what it actually means for their salaries. And there's also downsides to catch shares. And they're depending upon how they're implemented, you almost always see accumulation of catch on smaller and smaller number of vessels. So in Iceland, which has had catch shares for a long time, they call them the quota kings, that they're people who are very rich and own a very large share of the quota. The same thing has happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's a lot of resentment that a few people are now controlling the fishery or a lot of the fishery and are getting very rich as a result.
Okay, so you've laid out some pros and cons. Mm-hmm. You think it's a catch share would be a more efficient, more productive, safer way to allocate
yep.
fish. On the other hand, that means some fishers get shut out of the business. Yes.
Well, it's because but they sell out. They aren't kicked out. They end up making, you know, figuring out they're better off by selling their share and either going out of fishing or going into another fishery or whatever.
On balance, you're a fan of the catch share system.
As a concept, it just needs fine-tuning.
How does all this affect us here in Western Washington?
Probably very little, because the West Coast of the U.S. is one of the best managed places in the United States and in the world. In terms of, we have a very high proportion of the fisheries that are already in catch shares. The fisheries that aren't in catch shares, most of them are doing pretty well. Therefore, you know, if you say, well, the benefits we see are from increasing the effectiveness of fisheries management, which isn't going to happen in the U.S. because it's already effective, and in moving fisheries that aren't in catch shares into catch shares, the big fisheries in the West Coast trawl fishery, the Alaska halibut fishery, the pollock fisheries, the Alaska cod fishery, those are already in catch shares.
Overall, you know, it sounds like pretty good news. I'm used to reading some bleak things about fisheries. So, Ray Hilburn, what is the good news here?
Well, there's two layers of good news. The good news is the ocean is a potential source of enormous food, wealth, and employment. And with good fisheries management, we can achieve that. And the other good news is we already are achieving it in many places. And the U.S. is one of those. But we could do better everywhere. We could do a little better in the U.S.
University of Washington Fisheries Professor Ray Hilburn telling you about his work finding that the world's fisheries can recover mostly in under 10 years with what he calls common sense reforms to fishery management. It's KUOW's The Record.